Greetings, I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. A stimulating, provocative, enlightening, and revolutionary book is out now from the noted economist and political commentator Brian Lee Crowley. Fearful Symmetry, The Fall and Rise of Canada's Founding Values has gotten a number of good notices and favorable recommendations. It looks at Canada and how the 1960s ideals that brought about the new Canada are quickly losing favor and will soon give way to the so-called Old Canada and our traditional values of a ferocious work ethic, a commitment to the family as the most important social institution, and a suspicion of big government. For someone my age, these values seem foreign as they're not the ones I grew up with. Also, we'll discuss how Mr. Crowley views Canada as it is and how it will be, what with Quebec's influence waning and our workforce changing dramatically. It seems we'll be working longer. Brian Lee Crowley is the founding president of the Atlantic Institute for Market Studies. This book is published by Key Porter. The website for more is brianleecrowley.com. It's a fascinating, well-written book and one that challenges how one thinks about Canada. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Brian Lee Crowley. Good morning, Mr. Crowley.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
You establish what our founding values are. Why is it that we've forgotten our history?
Oh, boy. well, the argument that I make in the book is that, you know, the founding values of Canada, and when I say the founding values, I'm talking about the values that we can observe in the behavior of Canadians, and you talked about them in your introduction. We talk about this ferocious work ethic. We talk about a suspicion of government. We talk about commitment to family and so on. The reason, in my view, that we forgot about these values is that they actually became rather inconvenient. And they became inconvenient in the 1960s for two reasons. First of all, we had this giant baby boom generation kind of bearing down on us. I'm a member of that generation. And, you know, the movement of these boomers into the workforce created a long period of unemployment. You know, we had a 25-year-long period during which unemployment was always higher than it is today, and we're in the middle of a recession now in 2009. So, you know, we had this long period of unemployment, and that undermined our belief that there was always work for those who wanted it and were capable of it. People began to doubt that that proposition was true. Second thing that happened was that we had the rise of the baby boom generation in Quebec, which was very specific, very important development in the sense that they started hitting the labor market just at the time in the 1960s when there was no language legislation. The private sector was essentially closed to young French speakers, and so they ramped up the size of the state in Quebec in order to accommodate these young people looking for work. And that triggered, I argue in the book, a bidding war between Ottawa and Quebec City, in which the state was going to be used as the way to accommodate these young Quebecers. Ottawa couldn't afford to let Quebec get the monopoly on them, and so both levels of government expanded enormously, and you know, we began to worry that our old commitment to the work ethic, to small government, to not creating dependence through social programs and so on, might endanger the survival of the country.
So, in today's context, how foreign to Canadians are the concepts of personal responsibility, say?
Well, I don't think that they're foreign to the average Canadian. In fact, what I try and show in the book is that there's now a new two Canadas. You know, we used to talk about the two Canadas. We all remember Lord Durham famously came to Canada and said that he came and found two nations warring in the bosom of a single state. And we're used to thinking about those two Canadas being English-speaking and French-speaking. I argue in the book that what has essentially happened is that there's a new two Canadas. One is making Canada, and it's the bulk of the Canadian population. These are people who work hard, have a strong work ethic, don't want to be dependent, want to pay their own way. You know, these are familiar values to them. But we've also encouraged the growth of a second Canada, which I call taking Canada. These are people who have become used to the notion that it is possible to live essentially by taking through the state from the productive members of Canadian society. So we have both coexisting within Canada.
So what has subscribing to this post-war consensus of big government say? What do you think we've lost?
Well, you know, I think, for example, that it has really deeply undermined the belief that was really quite universal, as far as I can make out, in Canada before 1960, that work was absolutely essential to human development. You know, we believe that it didn't matter what kind of job you had, it didn't matter whether it was well paid or not, that was kind of irrelevant, that the important thing was that you be part of your development as a full human being required you to be responsible for yourself and work in order to, you know, make a contribution to society as well as to develop your own character. And I'm not saying that, you know, we've lost that completely in Canada. I think that's clearly not true. But we have developed a sort of a strain in Canadian society of people who say, you know, oh gosh, you know, there are certain kind of jobs that are that no one should be expected to do, and you know, there's no reason for us to encourage people to take those kinds of work. And I think what we've ended up doing is undermining the rewards that flow from work to people often at the bottom end of the education scale, the bottom end of the wage scale, and so on. They have been convinced, I think, by the things that they hear in the media and so on, that these kinds of jobs are beneath human dignity and so on. I think that's absolutely the wrong thing to believe. I believe that it is the worker that confers dignity on the work and not the work that confers dignity on the person. And I think when we dismiss the importance of any kind of work, we damage the possibilities of human beings developing themselves.
And now you mentioned that we'll work harder in the book, mm-hmm. and we'll work longer. Do you think that people will go to school more, perhaps, than before?
Well, that's very interesting. Now, just to give a little context to that, I mean, the reason that I suggest that people will work longer, or to put it a different way, we won't retire so young.
Yeah.
One of the reasons for that is because you know, we're about to enter an era in which you know, the ready supply of labor that we have enjoyed over the last 50 years, because there was this huge wave of boomers, that ready supply of labor is about to dry up. You know, we've had a 50-year-long period during which 250,000 people entered the workforce, new workers entered the labor force every year. And we're about to leave that period now and enter a period where, you know, new entrants are going to be almost zero. So there's going to be very little new labor supply or new workers available to do new things, and that's going to constrain economic growth. Now, one of the responses that we can have to that is to encourage people to work longer or not to retire so early. Canada has been, amongst Western countries, actually rather poor at putting people over 55 to work. That's probably pretty understandable if you think our problem is unemployment. You know, we paid a lot of people to retire early and kind of get out of the way so we could find jobs for the people coming up behind them. But it's a totally unsuitable response in a time of labor shortages. And so I think we're going to be rewarding people. We're going to be paying people, giving them incentives not to retire early. On the contrary, we're going to be giving them incentives to work longer.
But how do you foresee changes to our education system? Because we seem to see across the country our government tied to education, that access to education, funding for education comes from government.
Mm. Well, look, I actually think that there will be a lot of pressure on people to improve their educational qualifications because, you know, we're going to be looking to improve our productivity. And one of the best ways to do that is to have better trained workers who know more and can have more skills to put to work. You know, I think that there will continue to be big demand for schooling. But at the same time, you know, the pressure will be on for people not to spend so much time in school. You know, I think over the last, over the last 50 years, there's been an extent to which being in university was kind of an alternative to working. There was no particularly great pressure to move from schooling and into work and so on. I think the circumstances will be quite different now. People will be anxious to pull people from education into work because of this shortage of workers, and so there will be a lot of pressure on people not to dawdle, if I can put it that way, on their way through university. We'll want them to be well-trained, but we won't want them to take a lot of time to do it.
Now, what will happen then to the least in our society? Won't they suffer? There was a comment in the Globe and Mail talking about your book, saying that perhaps people that found wisdom in your book are the sort of people that have hard little hearts.
Mm. Yes, I read that. I must say that I think it's quite the reverse. You know, I think that we have wanting to do well, you know, wanting to do good. You know, we've created a bunch of programs, unemployment insurance, social welfare, and so on. That I don't want to get rid of them. I want to have them properly designed so that they don't draw people into dependence. You know, I think that there is a tremendous amount of research out there that demonstrates very clearly that when you draw people into dependence, you reward them for not working, that this has terribly damaging effects on their ability to succeed in the world. They actually get trapped on benefits, find it hard to escape, hard to get into work. And if you agree that work is part of how we as human beings create or develop ourselves, then I think having these badly designed programs that draw people into dependence is actually the cruel thing to do. And it's far better to have well-designed social programs that help to support us, through bouts of unemployment, like downturns like the one we're in right now, but that don't create long-term dependence, that in fact encourage people to get back into work as soon as they are able to do so. If you think that working is part of developing your human character and your personality, then you will not agree that a poorly designed welfare state is a benefit to the most vulnerable in our society. You'll think that a badly designed welfare state is the most damaging thing you can do for those people, and the best thing you can do for them is to find ways to encourage them and to get into work and give them the tools they need to succeed at it.
I asked you earlier about why we've forgotten these founding values. Over the last 40, 50 years or so, who do you blame for a lot of what has happened? Mm. I mean, are there politicians, perhaps? Is it the media? Is it historians, revisionists, perhaps?
Mm. Well, you know, I must admit, I try not to get into the blame game. I get asked this question quite a lot. You know, people say, do you blame Pierre Trudeau? You know, do you blame Rene Levesque? Do you blame so-and-so or so-and-so? I must say that what I've tried to do in the book is to be analytical, that is to say, to understand what happened. I don't feel the need to say, well, you know, the people who took the decisions that made these things happen were bad people or guilty people. I'm not sure that that's very helpful. I observe that a number of things happened. I happen to think that quite likely the people who took these decisions thought they were doing good, thought that they were probably saving the country from the threat of, Quebec separatism, for example. And I'm a bit reluctant after the fact to say to them, you know, you people deserve to be sanctioned by history. I think that the important thing for us is to understand, not to blame.
Well, when they're glamorized, like considered the greatest Canadian, or, you know, they have movies made about them, I mean, doesn't that stick in your craw, perhaps?
Well, that's a fair point. I mean, I certainly think that mistakes were made, but, you know, there is no era in which mistakes are not made. There are no perfect leaders and no perfect electorates. You know, we, as human beings always do, we made difficult decisions in times of imperfect information, and we did our best and got some of it right and some of it wrong. I think the important thing to remember is, if we can understand what went wrong, we stand a good chance of being able to fix it and perhaps do better this time, especially as we stand, as I believe we do, on the cusp of major change because of the withdrawal of the boomers and the labor shortages that I think we face. It's going to change everything.
So let's move on to Quebec now. You talk about the bidding war for the loyalty of Quebecers. That's on its way out. That's in its waning days. Why is it, do you think? Is it just people got tired of it, or was it the rest of Canada that itself rose up against it?
Well, I think it's quite interesting. I think that the bidding war was the result of tremendous bargaining power that Quebec achieved through this combination of large baby boom generation, high unemployment, and Quebec nationalism, threatening to break up the country. So that Ottawa's response was, my God, we've got to get in this bidding war. We've got to be able to attract young Quebecers to federalism, and the best way we can do that is to make them dependent on government jobs, transfers, social programs, etc. The argument I make in the book is that one of the consequences is that we have actually deeply damaged Quebec society, and what I mean by that is, they went from a society that was essentially competitive with Ontario in terms of its levels of employment, its productivity, its ability to attract investment, its ability to attract new immigrants, etc. And within a few decades, we turned it into a province that has low investment, low levels of employment, low levels of productivity, high levels of out-migration, low levels of immigration, low fertility, poor family formation. I mean, the list of dysfunction is really very long. And so the case I make is that we have actually undermined, through the bidding war, Quebec's ability to make a credible claim to their own people that if they leave Canada, they will be able to have a similar standard of living to the one that they enjoy today. So Quebec's ability to threaten leaving, I think, has been strongly weakened by what's happened in the last little while, in the last few decades. And at the same time, they've lost political and demographic weight within Canada. Their political strength is waning. I mean, we have seen in recent days reports in the newspapers that the federal government is about to announce that they're going to add 30 new seats to the House of Commons. Now, none of those seats will be in the province of Quebec. They're all going to be in BC, Alberta, and Ontario, those parts of Canada where the traditional values have remained the strongest, because those have become lands of opportunity. They attract investment, they attract new workers, they attract immigrants, and they have become the real attractive parts of Canada for people to come to. Well, if the size of the House of Commons, for instance, is going up, and Quebec's representation doesn't get any bigger, they're losing relative influence all the time, just as their economy is not growing as fast as the rest of the country's. They're not attracting immigrants. I mean, in all these ways, they are losing bargaining power within Canada. Now, I'm not saying it's going to disappear, but they are definitely going to swing less weight than they have in the past few years.
The bill that's supposedly going to be introduced to the House of Commons to increase the, as you said, the seats in BC, Alberta, and Ontario. The only thing that I was thinking about was how are they going to fit all those MPs in that chamber?
Well, in fact, the Canadian chamber is a lot bigger than the British chamber, which has over 600 members. So
that's right.
There's a lot of room. They may be a little elbow to elbow in there.
When you talk about the lack of the decline, I should say, of Quebec's influence, does that mean that we'll see more leaders from outside of say central Canada?
Well, wouldn't that be a welcome development?
From where you live now, or from where I live here in Vancouver, say on this side of the country?
Well, I mean, I certainly think the chances of us getting leaders from other parts of Canada will be increased. Now, of course, you know, after a long series of leaders from Quebec, you know, we all know we have a prime minister from Alberta who's been in office now for 3 or 4 years. I mean, that in itself, I think, is suggestive of the kind of changes that are coming. And the chances of someone, you know, like Stephen Harper, or remember that Joe Clark, even back in 1979, came within 5 or 6 seats of having a majority in Parliament with only, I think, 2 MPs from Quebec. So, I mean, it's going to happen. There is going to be one day a majority government in Canada which may have little or no representation in Quebec. And, you know, there was a time when that was unthinkable, and it now has become something that we regard as, you know, I think Canadians regard as something that will happen one day, and it won't be the end of the world.
How will Canada look in terms of immigration? Will we change all that much? Will there be more or less?
Well, I think there will be more, but, you know, I think there are practical limits to how much more there will be, and I think this is one of the things that Canadians haven't come to terms with. I think Canadians are living in a dream world when they think that, as I think many of them do, that, well, if we have a shortage of native-born Canadians, then we'll just open the doors and bring some more immigrants in, and what's the problem? I think people don't understand, you know, the size of the boomer generation and how their eventual withdrawal from the workforce is going to change things. If you wanted to use immigration to replace the boomers, in other words, to keep the same, you know, let's say the same number of 25-year-olds, the same number of 65-year-olds, so we wouldn't have population aging, we would have to increase the level of immigration by something like 7 times. Now, we already accept 200,000 immigrants a year, and that's the large. We are the country in the world that accepts the most immigrants relative to population of anybody. I think increasing immigration levels from their current level to 7 times what they are today is just practically fraught with difficulty, and I think politically would be almost impossible. And I say that as I say that as someone who is completely in favor of immigration. It's not that I don't want immigration. In fact, I'm quite sure there will be more of it, and I think that's a good thing. But I don't think it's even feasible for us to think about replacing the boomers with immigrants. There would not only have to be such a huge number of them as I've described, but they'd all have to be under 30. So we'd have to have some quite draconian rules about who we would allow to immigrate. And I think politically that would be quite difficult as well. So yes, there will be more immigration, but there couldn't possibly be as much as we would need in order to replace the boomers.
Whenever we think about ourselves, whenever we think about our country, Canada, the natural inclination is to compare ourselves to the United States, or to look at where the United States is compared to us. Where do you see the two countries in the future? Do you see us becoming less American, perhaps?
Well, that's a complex question, because, you know, I think America is in the throes of some very significant changes. And it's not quite clear to me yet where America is headed. On the other hand, it's becoming clearer to me where Canada is headed. Now, America's not going to have the kind of labor force challenges that we do. I mean, their labor force is not going to grow as much as in the past, because they've had a big baby boom generation. But on the other hand, they're having a lot more kids. They've basically got replacement rate fertility. So, you know, they're going to have 30% labor force growth. We're only going to have 11%. They're going to live quite differently in the future. They're already, you know, seeing this tremendous growth in what they call the exurbs, that is to say, beyond the suburbs, you know, these distant communities outside city centers. They're predominantly rural states like Idaho and Oregon and Colorado and so on are amongst the greatest growth states in the United States, whereas Canada is increasingly concentrated around a very small number of cities. and our labor force is growing more slowly. So, you know, there will be ways in which we will be quite different. America's population is moving more and more to the southwest. They're going to have much less experience of Canada. So all of these things will be factors that will matter. But I'm not ready to say that we will become less like the Americans. I think we will become more distant from them for some of the reasons that I've described.
Do you see much leadership in the Canadian political world today? Who there sees the country as you do, perhaps?
Well, you know, again, this is a... I'm not sure that politicians are going to lead this. In fact, I'm quite sure they won't. And so I don't worry too much, in a sense, about whether, you know, there are politicians who kind of get what I'm talking about, because, you know, just as Paul Martin, for instance, was dragged kicking and screaming into his fiscal reforms. In fact, you know, when he tabled his first budget after he became finance minister, it was very much a, you know, steady as you go, we're going to continue the deficit, we're not too worried, don't worry, be happy. By the time he got to his second budget, he had a serious dose of reality, and Canadians' attitudes about, you know, long-term deficits and growing debt and so on were beginning to shift, and he was dragged, I believe, by public opinion to doing things that he was not actually all that well disposed towards. So I think that the ability of politicians to look ahead and see these coming changes, I'm not convinced that that capacity is really there. But when the time comes and these changes have to be made, they will be dragged into it, whether they understand the need for it or not.
Where do you go from here? Because in reading the book, it seems to me it's not enough that you just wrote it. It seems that there's so much in here because of its contents, because of its you know, what it discusses, that it has to go further, that it has to be expanded upon, it has to be discussed. How do you see this book affecting Canadians further?
Well, I can tell you that, you know, I think that it's time to sort of raise the level of policy conversation in Canada, and believe me, I want to make it very clear, I'm not suggesting I'm getting into politics, because I think that would be a terrible mistake, that I'm not suited to that, but I do think that, for instance, I've been talking about the idea of starting a national think tank in Ottawa, with the idea of, you know, bringing some of these ideas to the national stage and talking to people in all parties about them, because I think they are so terribly important. And like you, I think it's not enough to write a book and say, well, there it is, do what you will with it. I actually think we have to work with Canadians, just as we did on the issue of deficits and debts, and we changed the minds of Canadians about what we had to do. I think we have to confront this new set of issues and put some new ideas in Canadians' heads, and I'd like to play my part in that, and maybe I'll get a new national think tank going in Ottawa and use that as a platform to talk about these issues.
Brian, it's been a pleasure talking today. There's so much more we could talk about. Congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it.
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you today.
Thanks very much. It is a magnificent book, Fearful Symmetry, The Fall and Rise of Canada's Founding Values, published by Key Porter. For more, check out brianleecrowley.com. The author of the book, Brian Lee Crowley, on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.